Hello, all you happy people. Welcome to Stick to Shorts. My name is J.D. Hansel, and this show is my excuse to learn more about classic cartoons. What do I mean by classic cartoons? I'm talking about classical, theatrical, animated shorts. These are the animated films produced for movie theaters during the classical Hollywood period. That makes this, technically, a movie review podcast. So if you know what movie review podcasts are like, this is that. If you take a look at the show notes, you'll find content warnings so you know what you're getting yourself into. If you'd like to know what we'll be covering next so you can follow along with us, and you'd like to know where you can find the cartoon on streaming or home video, check out our Blue Sky page at Stick to Shorts. This time, instead of jumping right into my chat with my guest, I'll do a little bit more of a preamble than I have the past couple of episodes. I'm recording this part separately from that conversation, so I have time to give you some more context for what we're watching this week. This first season of the podcast, you may recall, is my brief tour of some of the big studios and filmmakers that defined the cartoon shorts of Hollywood animation's golden age. It's to give you the lay of the land in an easy and approachable way without throwing you into the silent era right out of the gate. Previously on Stick to Shorts, we've covered a few major, essential, big-deal cartoons: Porky and Wacky Land, One Froggy Evening, Brave Little Taylor. This week's cartoon, Dumbhounded, is not on the same tier, so I'd better tell you why we're covering it this early, especially since the first part of that title, a word that I don't usually feel super comfy throwing around casually, the most honest answer, as you've probably already figured out, is that I have borrowed my introductory phrase at the top of each episode from this cartoon and from its star. That's right, this short marks the first appearance of a character I identify with very strongly and might think of as sort of a mascot for the podcast. It's Droopy.
Hello, all you happy people. You know what? I'm the hero.
As I was thinking of how to whittle down this genre of thousands and thousands of shorts into ones worth covering within the first few dozen episodes or so, it seemed to me that one justification for a short's consideration would be if it was the first appearance of a recurring major character. I think whether or not Droopy is a major character is debatable, but if he isn't, that's kind of odd. He starred in a couple dozen cartoons, which has nothing on the likes of, you know, Bugs Bunny or Tweety, but for a modest filmography, his career boasts a good percentage of successes. These include the highly acclaimed Tex Avery film Northwest Hounded Police and the Academy Award nominee One Droopy Night. He's one of the few characters that MGM kept circling back to through the 40s and 50s. Hey, this is our first time visiting another one of the Hollywood studios we'll be spending a lot of time with on this show, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, better known simply as MGM. This is the movie studio behind such cinematic classics as The Wizard of Oz, Singin' in the Rain, North by Northwest, and Ben-Hur. Nowadays, I think we primarily associate the classic MGM era with its musicals, and for good reason. But that was just part of its reputation at the time for big, beautiful, snazzy, expensive Technicolor pictures. Film historian Leonard Maltin, in his book Of Mice and Magic, described MGM as the Tiffany's of motion picture studios. He writes, quote, "At one time, it boasted more stars than there are in heaven, and these luminaries were showcased by the top directors, writers, cameramen, art directors, costume designers, and technicians in Hollywood. Even MGM's grade B pictures were slick and good-looking. There was no question that MGM would demand commensurate quality from its cartoon department, but it quickly discovered that there are some things money cannot buy." End quote. You see, in the years after Mickey Mouse first appeared, all the studios decided they needed cartoons. MGM wanted the best, so they made a deal to distribute cartoons made by the man who first drew Mickey Mouse, Ub Iwerks. After a few years, they upgraded to two other ex-Disney animators, Hugh Harmon and Rudolph Ising. You might remember from our first episode, somehow, if you have five brains, that Harmon and Ising are the guys who started Looney Tunes. MGM was able to offer them double the budget they got from Leon Schlesinger's studio at Warner Brothers. I guess it's worth underlining here that these animation studios like Disney and Harmon Ising, and the one we'll get into in the next episode, Fleischer, were their own production companies that the movie studios had distribution deals with. In the late 30s, however, MGM decided to change that. they brought the cartoon department in-house. They put the animators in a building on the main studio lot, as if to elevate MGM's animated shorts to about the same status as their live-action features. That's pretty different from the low status of the Looney Tunes animators working in a building outside the gates of the backlot, a building they dubbed Termite Terrace. So, by the 1940s, MGM was a relatively good place to be making cartoons. It came with status, good wages for the time, access to the MGM song library, and MGM's full orchestra. It had a lot of the best animators, many of them from the Disney studio, but there was no Walt Disney demanding total creative control of the product. The producer didn't know anything about how to make good cartoons, but he didn't pretend to, so there was typically a fair amount of creative freedom. The budgets were high, and the production schedules were long, enabling the directors to take the time they needed to get their cartoons just right. That's one heck of a deal. And in the early 40s, that deal was offered to one of the most influential directors in animation history, Tex Avery. I talked about Tex Avery a bit in the first episode, but didn't actually cover one of his films, so it seems like a good idea to spotlight his work as early as possible, given his prevalence in the animation world. He is, after all, the filmmaker who introduced Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. You may remember, Avery is the guy who came to Warner Brothers in the mid-30s, eager to shake things up and do bold, wild, outrageous cartoons that moved away from the cutesiness and realism that Disney was doing. I realize now that I probably should have been putting voices to some of these names, since I can't show you their faces on an audio podcast, and they're going to be a little hard to remember if you're not already totally into the cartoon world. So here's a short clip of Avery talking about his approach to making cartoons.
Of course, we all know that Disney was the king of the mountain, and as far as cartoons went, with his silly symphonies. But we couldn't compete. In my case, I couldn't compete with Disney, and I didn't attempt to. I attempted to do things that Disney wouldn't dare to do. What I'm getting at is exaggeration in films, wild takes, distorted fairy tales, and I laid off of the fuzzy wuzzy little bunnies. I made parodies on quite a few fairy tales, almost kidding Disney, because it wasn't my bag along the cute lines. So in my career, I always attempted to exaggerate. Everything I did was exaggeration.
Now, I know I initially made it sound kind of like Avery was the first person to introduce the idea that animation could eschew realism, but it's really a bit more complicated than that. Animation historian Michael Barrier, I've switched over to historian instead of saying historian to try to sound, you know, I guess that, I mean, this is what I'm supposed to say. This is English, right? I don't know. Still feels weird. Michael Barrier explains in his book Hollywood Cartoons, quote, "It was not just that he strongly preferred impossible things, like those that had turned up so often in the Bosco cartoons, as well as the Oswald cartoons that he helped make at Universal. Other directors, like Wilford Jackson, felt the same way. Alone among cartoon directors in the mid-30s, Avery accepted the challenge of finding a way to make such gags work in the climate created by Disney's logical fantasies." End quote. In the Brave Little Taylor episode, I think we talked a little bit about the plausible impossible, this idea Disney embraced that, with the right technique, you can give impossible, fantastical things a kind of logic to them that makes them feel believable. We saw in that cartoon how a good understanding of physicality could make even simple moments a lot more impactful. So in today's cartoon, you'll see that Tex is able to apply a kind of physics that makes sense, a very convincing effect of high speed, for example, and apply it to gags that are so exaggerated and over the top that they shouldn't make sense. You also get moments when that physical logic is suddenly abandoned, which is a lot more striking and interesting than if it had never been there at all. And yet, Barrier's criticism of this short is that it doesn't take the extremity far enough. He writes, quote, "That the phlegmatic dog could anticipate the frantic wolf's every move, much less beat him to every hiding place he chose, was, of course, a ridiculous premise. It thus offered a challenge tailor-made for Avery, since the premise had to be argued with utter conviction to conquer the audience's natural reservations. This was where Dumbhounded failed. a casualty of the ongoing tension in Avery's early cartoons between his own predilections and those of his artists. Dumbhounded moves a little too slowly, and the wolf's reactions when he sees Droopy are too mild, so there are too many opportunities for doubt to insinuate itself. End quote. He goes on to contrast this with the much faster remake of this cartoon from just a few years later, Northwest Hounded Police, which has much bigger reactions from the wolf. If today's cartoon, Dumbhounded, seemed familiar to you, but also not, it's probably because you've seen that cartoon, Northwest Hounded Police, which is much more popular. But two things about that. One, this cartoon is conveniently on the first volume of Tex Avery Screwball Collection, and I want to cover some more cartoons on that disc someday within the first 2 years of this podcast's life, should it live so long? So I'm giving this one priority. You will find both of Droopy's police chase cartoons on the DVD Tex Avery's Droopy, The Complete Theatrical Collection. Two, I think this picture is delightful. I'm definitely saving a lot of Avery's best work for later by starting here instead, but I do think this one's a good time. Talking about it with Ryan, I think we found that we both like it quite a bit. We both laughed, and we got a pretty good sense of Avery's style from it, even if Avery hadn't quite reached his peak yet. So, thank you for bearing with me for that context, and now here's my conversation with my friend Ryan Rowe about Tex Avery, Droopy, and Dumbhounded. Joining me for this really necessary trip through Toontown is one of my friends and one of my editors from toughpigs.com. It's Ryan Rowe. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me. And I'm so impressed that you registered sticktoshorts.com.
Thank you.
That's so professional.
I've been very pleased. I don't know why why people
haven't... Nobody had claimed it for like a clothing company that only sells shorts?
No. Stick to Pants was taken. Stick to Shirts was taken.
Yeah,
and those were the titles I wanted to go with for the podcast.
Right. That would have made so much sense for this podcast.
Yeah. Let's go. Do you know the Stick to Shorts story?
Well, I do actually, because I listened to a preview of your first episode that you posted.
Ah, yes.
In Discord that some of our friends are in. So, yes, I do now because of you.
See, folks, it's already working.
Yeah,
I'm already teaching people my questionable understanding of the history of animation. Now, Ryan, you and I talked about what you might want to discuss on this podcast. And you brought up Droopy as one of many possibilities. So I want to get a sense, first of all, just generally, what your history is with Tex Avery, with his cartoons, with his stuff at MGM. How did you see it? How do you feel about it?
I think I sort of started becoming aware of individual animation directors around the time of Bugs Bunny's 50th anniversary, which was what year? Do you know off the top of your head? I was a kid.
It would have to be 1990.
Okay, so I was 9 years old, and I bought a Bugs Bunny 50th anniversary magazine that had some little profiles of different directors who had worked on Bugs Bunny cartoons. So that's kind of when I became aware of who they all were and kind of a little bit about what their individual styles were. And then as I became more of a nerd and read up on more of this stuff, I kind of started to identify which ones were, I don't know, like kind of what to expect from each director.
Right.
And Tex Avery, I think people who are nerds about this stuff kind of think of Tex Avery as being one of, if not the wackiest of the Looney Tunes directors.
Yeah. Him and Clampett, basically, yes.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I remember Cartoon Network had a compilation show called The Tex Avery Show, where I think they would show a combination of some Warner Brothers shorts and some MGM shorts.
I've never heard of this, but that sounds great.
Yeah, it was around the time they were doing Toon Heads, which was another kind of classic cartoons, possibly aimed at older, nerdier fans.
Right. It's all the stuff that I missed, all the stuff that I was too young for. That sounds perfect.
At a certain point, when I saw Tex Avery's name as the director in the opening credits of one of these shorts, I kind of like that was one to stand up and pay attention to, because it was going to be very silly and very funny.
Yeah, and probably at least in certain parts, very fast.
Yeah.
Like it was not going to be one of those very patient, measured explorations of psychology that you get from Chuck Jones. It was going to be fast.
Yeah, definitely.
and pretty explosive in more ways than one. I saw Tex Avery cartoons on Boomerang. On the TV station at some point when I was a kid. This was well after I was familiar with Looney Tunes. I would see, just kind of thrown in the mix between shows, you'd get one random MGM cartoon, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, it's starting like a Tom and Jerry cartoon for a second, and then it's not a Tom and Jerry cartoon. Like, it throws you. It's that same music at the very beginning, and then something completely different, and it's like,
yeah, it's that same little fanfare.
What's this? What is Red Hot Riding Hood? What are we doing here?
It's different, and it's more exciting than the average Tom and Jerry cartoon.
It is. I'm a big Tom and Jerry fan. I have not found a lot of other people to talk to for this podcast who are big Tom and Jerry fans, unfortunately. But there's definitely something a bit more exciting about seeing the Tex Avery stuff.
Yeah. Well, actually, I will say, my nephews, this is good news about young people discovering these cartoons. My nephews, who are 9 and 5, have really gotten into Tom and Jerry. I don't know where they're watching them, actually, but revisiting some of those with them, like those early Tom and Jerry cartoons are genuinely really funny, like laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, for a while there, they had a pretty incredible run. Like, I really think the early years of Hanna and Barbera directing Tom and Jerry are reliable. Like, how you can kind of just, like, put on almost any of those cartoons, and you're going to get a visual treat and quite a few laughs and surprises. I mean, I can save this for an episode about Tom and Jerry, I guess, but...
Sure.
They shake up the formula pretty much every time. You expect a lot of them will probably end up being typical cat and mouse cartoons.
Right.
And then when you actually watch it, it's like, no, they almost invariably introduce some other element to make it really interesting and something different.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, they were influenced by what Tex Avery was bringing to the studio and the speed that he brought, all that. So I really developed a liking for Droopy in particular when I was watching these on Boomerang. I feel like I had known or seen the character somewhere before, but he stood out to me because he captures, as a very tired man, just generally, as someone whose default state of being is tired, I find that he captures something about my personality, maybe even my soul.
Yeah, I guess one thing, and I don't know if this even really occurred to me when I was a kid, but Droopy is generally more passive than a lot of his contemporaries, the other cartoon characters of the day, where I was realizing watching this cartoon that we're going to talk about and some of the other ones on the DVD that I have, which is that complete Droopy collection. In a lot of these cartoons, Droopy's really not even the protagonist. The protagonist is like the bad guy, essentially, who is trying to bully Droopy. And then Droopy just kind of sleepily walks through the cartoon and then wins at the end.
Right. There's not as much of a morality play in a way. I mean, we can talk about what on earth the values of this cartoon that we're going to talk about today are, if there are any. But I mean, I guess it's sort of a Hays Code crime doesn't pay kind
of
thing.
Crime doesn't pay. Yeah, exactly.
In a way. But, you know, raising an eyebrow at that at the same time.
Right.
And yet, you're right, that there's something about these Droopy cartoons where you can never quite tell who is actually the lead and who is actually the star. And it kind of doesn't matter because the conflict is interesting either way.
It's occurring to me right now, I guess you could compare him to the Roadrunner in that way, where the other character is... Like that, I guess that's more true of the later cartoons, though, not so much this one, but the other character is trying to do things to him, and he's just kind of avoiding them through sheer cartoon luck or magic or whatever it is.
Right. But I do think Droopy's most famous cartoon is almost certainly Northwest Hounded Police, which is basically a remake of this cartoon, like pretty, not just basically, it's a pretty close remake of this cartoon.
Yeah, almost the exact same thing.
And yet that, like, Droopy is the one pursuing someone in that cartoon. It's just that
that's true.
You don't, and in this cartoon, it's just that you don't see the pursuit. That's what's so strange about Droopy, is that you really don't get, I mean, you see a little bit at the beginning, but for the most part, for as much as these are sort of chase cartoons, they are also anti-chase cartoons.
He's chasing very slowly.
And also very quickly. Like, you just get the beginning and end of a chase over and over and over.
Yes, yeah.
And so, like, the chase itself, the actual hunt that normally is what would make up this kind of a cartoon, whether it's, you know, Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, Tom and Jerry, is very deliberately being omitted, and that is the joke, and that is the point of the cartoon. It's really subversive and strange.
That's right. Those are the parts we don't see.
It's about the notes you don't play. That's what this is.
Oh, there you go.
All right. So I already kind of teased this, but there's this interesting quote from Eric Goldberg that I found in the documentary King Size Comedy. That's a documentary about Tex Avery. That's a bonus feature on one of these DVDs or Blu-rays. He says, this is Eric Goldberg, the very famous animator now, I think, associated with mostly Disney stuff, but he's done a lot. He's done some Looney Tunes and all that. I think animation fans know the name. He said, "One of my favorite Tex gags from MGM is in Northwest Hounded Police, where the wolf is running so fast, he skids off the edge of the film, and you see the sprocket holes going." That's in that cartoon. That's in Northwest Hounded Police.
Right.
But, of course, it was done first in Dumbhounded.
Yeah, it's in this one first, yeah.
And so I think it's interesting that you'll see a lot of things that would later get a lot of credit in a different cartoon first appearing here in what is the first ever appearance of Droopy.
Yeah. And are there other Droopy cartoons besides those two that kind of repeat that same basic gag, or is it really just those two?
I think it's just those two. I'll admit,
okay,
I
sort of have this nebulous idea that they did it again, but maybe that's just from seeing the same cartoons multiple times because they were rerun so many times.
Right. They did other stuff with Droopy and the wolf that feels kind of similar.
Right.
But I think
that's right. Yeah.
But it's a lot of stuff about how Droopy is just impervious and unbeatable. No matter what you do, you can't beat Droopy. He's always going to be there and just sort of respawn in a way.
Exactly, yes.
So let's get into it. This week's trip through Toontown takes us to 1943. The studio is MGM, the director is Tex Avery, the cartoon is Dumbhounded.
You moved, didn't you?
This is usually when I like to list the credited animators, but there are no credits at the top of this short besides Tex Avery and producer Fred Quimby. I suspect there used to be. Supposedly, Droopy wasn't named until Senior Droopy in 1949, and the copies of Dumbhounded I watch have Droopy's name at the front, so I imagine the titles used to start differently. On the other hand, the model sheet for Dumbhounded has Droopy's name on it, but also refers to him once as the dope. So I don't know what to make of this. I've got some conflicting evidence here. In any case, I am going to tell you that the animators are Ray Abrams, Preston Blair, and Ed Love, and Urban Spence, with the caveat that this info is from Wikipedia and could be bogus. It cites a source, but I have not yet bought a copy of the book that it cites, so I don't know about the accuracy.
I was wondering about his name because they don't actually use the name ever within the cartoon itself. And I did read that somewhere, maybe on Wikipedia, that he wasn't named until a later cartoon. So I bet you're right about them adding that title card of Droopy later.
Maybe so. Maybe so. If anyone knows, somewhere for this, there will be a comment section on probably, let's say, the Blue Sky post. You can find me over there.
There you go.
With that said, I feel much better about the accuracy of the voice acting credits, because for that, I can cite animation historian Keith Scott. He specializes in voice actor credits and is an accomplished voice actor himself. He's written a few books about this, but since I have not yet added those books to my growing animation history library, hopefully I'll get there. What I'm going to cite here is an article that he wrote for the website Cartoon Research, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. According to Scott, the wolf and the mayor are played by Frank Graham. He was a radio performer who had played narrators in a few cartoons at Warner Brothers and MGM, and previously played a version of this wolf character in Red Hot Riding Hood, which was recorded before this cartoon released a couple of months after. Droopy is played by radio comedian Bill Thompson, and this voice is a variation on a character that he played named Wallace Wimple on the NBC radio show Fibber McGee and Molly.
Oh, it's Wallace Wimple. Hi, Wimple, old man.
Hello, Mr. Wimple.
Hello, folks.
Won't you have a cup of tea, Mr. Wimple?
Oh, no, thank you, Mrs. McGee.
I find that tea stimulates me too much.
Tea does?
Yes. 3 or 4 cups of strong tea, and I simply am not accountable for what I do.
Well, say, that's very interesting, Mr. Wimple. How does it affect you?
Well, last night I was in a kind of a I-don't-care mood, and I made myself some tea. Then I picked up a can of caviar that said, keep in a cool place, and deliberately set it right on the stove.
Oh.
Sometimes I hate myself for losing control like that.
This comes up a lot in these cartoons, where somebody starts off with a particular character that they're known for the radio, and then a cartoon studio plucks them and pulls them in to do a cartoon character that's basically the same thing. I mean, that's Elmer Fudd. But
also, for all those old-time radio fans out there, don't open that closet, McGee.
I'm sure Anthony Strand specifically appreciates that, and hopefully a few other folks.
Yes, yes, hopefully a few others.
Thompson was not the voice of Droopy in every Droopy cartoon. He had to serve in the U.S. Navy during World War II, so Don Messick played him a few times, and it is believed that Tex Avery voiced the character himself in some cartoons.
Oh.
But Droopy always had essentially the voice that Thompson created, and Thompson would later use variations on the same voice for some of his many characters for the Disney studio in the 1950s. I personally associate this voice with Mr. Smee from Peter Pan.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Since we're talking about Droopy, I've got this quote from Courage the Cowardly Dog creator John R. Dilworth. He called Droopy a terrific character, that sort of narcoleptic, lovable creature that doesn't do harm to anyone, but seems to be in the middle of all sorts of potential harm. End quote. I love hearing anyone praise Droopy because generally in these cartoons, people want to praise the wolf or the other character opposed to Droopy.
What's the name of the bulldog from the later cartoons?
Someone's yelling it at us right now. I want
maybe
to
I shouldn't
say,
have asked the question.
I want to say that that's Spike, but I think there might be another character named Spike, and I get mixed up about that strange aspect of the MGM cartoons, that they've got multiple characters with the same name. I, for one, think that Droopy is inherently interesting, in part for the reasons I've mentioned, and in part for the fact that he's sort of a Tex Avery screwball character in the vein of Screwy Squirrel, Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, but he's on the other side of Bugs, which is to say that if you've got Daffy and the Dodo Bird over on, I mean, Dodo Bird's not a Tex Avery character, but if you've got that kind of character on one side of Bugs, the other side of Bugs, the cool, relaxed side that isn't bouncing up and down all the time, except at very selective moments, but is just generally very relaxed and nevertheless comes out the winner, that's where Droopy is.
Yeah, Droopy is not very screwy himself.
Until the right moments. There will be a few specific moments where he breaks, usually at the very end of the cartoon.
Yes.
But
and then he tells us he's happy.
Right, which is exactly the ending that I want. I want my little guy to be happy.
Sure.
Animator and historian John Canemaker noted that Droopy is very much a dog in this cartoon, but later becomes, quote, a little man in a dog suit. And I rather like this version of Droopy and later versions of Droopy, all versions of Droopy.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, too. Early on, we see him disappear behind the fire hydrant, and then he comes out looking embarrassed. And then he exchanges barks with another dog who's drawn to look more like a real dog. And then he looks at us and says, dog talk. They would never do that again in a later Droopy cartoon because he does just become, he's a biped and he just doesn't really act like a dog in the later cartoons.
The title of this cartoon is, of course, a play on the term dumbfounded, which is one of those words I'm not comfortable using in everyday conversation that doesn't seem to bother anybody but me. This is one of my personal things where it's like, I feel weird about this one. Anything you know, with the legacy of words like dumb and like, I don't have a good feeling about it, but most everybody else does.
Yeah, that had not occurred to me, but I think you're onto something there, actually.
This cartoon opens with two puns on screen. The sign above the prison reads, Swing Swing Prison, Crook of the Month Club. Sing Sing Correctional Facility comes up a lot in old Hollywood gangster movies, or perhaps more so in parodies of them. So I didn't think it was still running today, but apparently Sing Sing is still very much a thing in operation.
Well, there was just a critically acclaimed movie called Sing Sing, which I assume takes place there, so...
There was also a movie called Sing 2 that does not take place there.
No, that's unrelated.
What's interesting about these puns is that neither is really connecting multiple ideas that pertain to the scene or the story. This prison isn't swinging, and there's nothing about a book subscription service in this cartoon.
Yeah, so they're just kind of puns for the sake of being puns. It's kind of like a Mad Magazine style wordplay thing.
Right. Yeah, this is a really good introduction, I think, to how Tex Avery jokes tend to work. Like, the cause of the gags and the logic behind them are largely beside the point. Tex is focused on the quantity of the gags and the extremity of the gags and just gags for gag's sake.
Yeah, that's it.
It's nighttime, and we see a prisoner successfully escape from his cell, only for every light to come on at once. A spotlight hits him, but he runs out of it, leaving behind footprints that run up and over the prison wall, and a red arrow pointing up from the words, "I went that-a-way." Now, this is our first proper example of a Tex Avery signage gag on this podcast. It's going to come up again and again, and sometimes in the work of other directors, like Frank Tashlin. But it's quite prominent in this cartoon, and I always love to see it.
Oh, yeah. Frank Tashlin is another one of the really wacky ones, but he moved on to live-action movies, so
right.
He didn't direct as many shorts, right?
Not as many, no.
Yeah.
He directed a few. He definitely has his moments where he can get really, really wacky and out there, but he also brings some of that talent of a live action director who can think about things differently. And
right,
when I think about Tashlin's work, I think about shots as though he was a cinematographer, not just layouts the way I would with the rest of these directors. Like, he just has a more cinematic eye that he brings to it.
That's interesting. But sorry, that was an interruption. Continue.
I appreciate it. Tangents are welcome here. Speaking of which, as far as the signage gags go, what about, like, the Wile E. Coyote cartoon signs? Like, do those seem similar to you to an Avery kind of thing? Because I've been thinking about it, and I'm like, I associate these signs that say, you know, "Long, isn't it?" or something like that, as being very much a Tex Avery thing. But the way that Wile E. Coyote will hold up signs to sort of comment on his action is sort of in conversation with this.
Yeah, I guess I think of them as all being kind of connected, if only because it's just like a thing that happens in cartoons.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to think about that, because the Wile E. Coyote signs are communicating directly with the audience from him, a character in the cartoon, whereas I don't know that happens in these, but that's mostly because Wile E. Coyote doesn't talk.
Right. So they're serving more as speech bubbles.
Right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The joke there is that he's able to instantly make these appear and use them for speech.
Yes.
Whereas here, the joke is more about how needless it is for everything to get interrupted by this additional commentary that generally feels like it's from Tex Avery himself. It feels like it's from the filmmaker.
Exactly. Yeah. In the case of "Long, isn't it?" That feels like the cartoon itself communicating with us rather than a character.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll explore this some more throughout this cartoon. Do we think the wolf is supposed to be some version of the big bad wolf having been arrested for something he did in one of his fairy tales?
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's about all that can be said about that, is that it's interesting. It's a headcanon if you want
said...
to.
You said the Red Hot Riding Hood cartoon came out after this?
Yes, I think it was made before, but came out
okay,
after.
Okay, so is this the first appearance of this wolf character type in a Tex Avery cartoon?
It's a variation on the Hitler wolf in Blitz Wolf, which came out before this.
Okay, so if it's Hitler, then he definitely belongs in prison.
No, I didn't think about that. I did not consider the possibility that this could be Hitler. Okay.
Yeah.
Dozens of police bloodhounds come running out of the prison, followed by a little droopy, chugging along to tuba music. He turns to the audience and says, "Hello, all you happy people. You know what? I'm the hero." And as he talks, you see he has a full set of teeth, which is pretty unusual for a cartoon star that isn't a villain. Love to see it. He slowly continues on and steps behind a fire hydrant. When he walks out from behind it, he gives us an embarrassed smile and turns red with embarrassment. This is very much potty humor, which I don't usually like, but I think this is just about as clever and tasteful as it can be done. So
yeah, it's pretty subtle. We don't even see him lift his leg.
Yeah, we talked about how he encounters a happy, energetic dog, and the two bark at each other, and then he turns to us and says, dog talk. This was presumably a slang term, right? Like, this is a term, I guess? We know Tex loves to play with slang, but when I Googled it, I got results about doggo lingo and internet language that appears in memes about dogs. Didn't really give me any clarity here. I like that the frisky dog's barks sound totally real while Droopy's barks sound very human, yet like they still understand each other perfectly. And you know what that reminds me of?
It reminds you either of Ralph the dog in The Great Muppet Caper barking at the guard dogs at the art gallery, or it reminds you of Ralph the dog in A Muppet Family Christmas barking with Sprocket from Fraggle Rock.
It was, in fact, the second one, but I should have also thought of the first one. Droopy follows the wolf's footprints. I almost said Droopy follows the Rolf's footprints into a trash can, and a sign pops out that says, nope, I'm not in here. So Droopy keeps on walking.
Yeah, there's another sign.
Another sign.
Did we mention that the newspaper headline specifies that the dogs are bloodhounds?
No.
Because Droopy eventually will become established as a basset hound, but here he's specifically referred to as a bloodhound.
Part of the strange evolution of this character. I don't think he looks like the other dogs at all. He always stands out, which I really like. Even that sign stretches beautifully as it gets pulled down into the can. Everything's moving so elegantly here with so much energy even before the energetic part has really started. So the wolf pops out of the can and starts running, his legs doing the pinwheel thing. He runs up into an apartment or hotel room of some sort, locks the door and says, sure was a cinch getting rid of that little mutt. Without noticing, he walks right into Droopy, who says, that's what you think, brother. The wolf stays nose to nose with Droopy as he fully bends over Droopy in a state of shock, and his legs shoot up over his head. He bolts for the door, and on the other side finds Droopy standing there, immediately confirming that Droopy's abilities are straight up impossible.
You stay right here while I go and call the cops. Now promise me you won't move.
Okay, Doc. Suck it.
The wolf promises, and a little halo appears over his head. In this shot, the wolf really looks like a Disney character to me, and not just because of the gloves. There's something about his movement here that feels like a different style of performance than I'm used to seeing in Tex Avery cartoons, or really anything from MGM or Warner Brothers. I think it's because the wolf is being overly performative about being good-natured.
Yeah, you think they did that on purpose so he, because he's pretending to be mm-hmm. a goody-goody?
Mm-hmm.
I think
they deliberately made him seem more like a Disney character in his movement and style in that moment, so for the sake of his performance.
Wow.
I could be wrong. That's just the feeling
I get
from it.
Yeah, that's a good theory.
As Droopy closes the door, the wolf runs out the window and begins my favorite sequence in the whole cartoon.
This is also my favorite sequence, yes. And
it's
when I
best.
Was a kid, I loved this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I think it's one of the best sequences in all of MGM's cartoon filmography, really. The William Tell Overture plays, and he moves at an absurdly fast pace, running down the fire escape into a taxi. The taxi moves so fast, it drives up onto the walls as it takes a turn, then squashes until it's vertical when it comes up to a train station named RR Choo Choo Trains. My favorite thing about this part is, from here on out, we don't see the wolf on foot until he gets to his destination. Whenever he changes vehicles, he rides another mode of transportation in or out of the vehicle.
Yes, he's coming out of one vehicle, riding on another vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Here, he drives a Vespa, I guess, out of the taxi
scooter,
and onto the train. The train zips over mountains and stops at a dock. The wolf drives a buggy out of the train onto a ship. He drives a Jeep out of the ship and into an air terminal. And a whole passenger airplane flies out of the terminal. He rides a horse off of the plane through the woods and gets off the horse when he arrives at a log cabin. All of that happens in the span of 30 seconds.
Oh, nice.
That poor horse is wearing a surprised expression the whole time. Like he didn't know he was going to be in this cartoon any more than we did. And he has no idea what's going on.
Wow.
The approach to speed in this cartoon and other Avery shorts... it's actually heavily influenced by Disney's silly symphony, The Tortoise and the Hare from 1935, directed by Wilfred Jackson. I don't know whether or not I mentioned that in the first episode of this podcast, but here you can really see it. They, like, the early Warner directors, or like, not the earliest, but I mean, that definitive Termite Terrace crew was really jazzed about the speed effects in Tortoise and the Hare with the streak lines and how they were able to really realistically convey a sense of speed that didn't just feel like they were taking shortcuts, like just moving a character too fast out of bad animation, but looked like it had an understanding of physics to it. And you really see that here.
Yeah, it's everything is moving so fast, but you can still follow what's happening.
Right. And here you see like the streaks of black coming from the wolf's outfit. There's like that smearing effect from the train and the plane as well. But when the train comes to a stop, there's no secondary action, I think is the term. It just stops, which is completely out of place from all of the other movements in the cartoon. And so it's like the train that gets a laugh out of me when I watch this now. In the log cabin, the exhausted wolf turns around to see Droopy casually leaning against the wall, who says, "You moved, didn't you?" What follows is a rapid series of reactions from the wolf that are definitive of classic cartoon acting, with legs leaping over his head and eyes bulging out of his skull in a series of extremes.
They had to come up with so many different...
So many!
Takes, so many different cartoon takes for the wolf to do. Every single one is different.
Mm-hmm. It's great. These animators are actors. They are some of the greatest performers of the silver screen. What I love about this moment is not just the reactions, though. It's also the juxtaposition between the wolf's reactions and Droopy's lack of reaction.
Oh, sure.
I think this is why Droopy comes out of this as the star, in a way, even though the wolf design is so prominent in so many of Tex Avery's best cartoons. Like, any character could be giving the big expressions that everyone loves from these cartoons, I think. But Droopy is decidedly and uniquely himself. Even with less expression, he's much more of a defined character.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you do want to see more of him. And like you were saying, you want to see him win because he's just this odd little guy.
Droopy is the ideal character to pair with whoever you want to have do really big exaggerated expressions with eyes popping out.
Right.
The wolf ties up Droopy and leaves the cabin, and then the entire sequence we just saw plays in reverse.
With the music sped up even more.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yes.
Tex could always find ways to reuse ideas and material. And I think it's interesting that he managed to reuse a whole scene within the same cartoon.
Yes.
In such a creative and appropriate way that makes it like that makes the whole cartoon better.
It doesn't feel lazy. Yeah. It's just one-upping itself.
Right. Like it was probably a cost-saving measure to do it this way instead of like animate him, you know, running all the way back, but it's better this way. This is exactly what it should be. It's perfect.
Yeah.
The wolf finds Droopy waiting in the room where he started and questions how Droopy did that. Droopy replies, "Now let's not get nosy, bub." The wolf bundles him up in the sheets, although it's not clear why he thought that would go any better than it did a few seconds ago.
I mean, but at this point, why does he think anything's going
to
work?
I know. He starts to figure it out soon. He starts sliding down the banister and Droopy taps him from behind where he is also sliding down the banister and says, "Fun, isn't it?"
With that level of enthusiasm.
The wolf, which is also how I react to things in real life. That is my level of enthusiasm for things that I enjoy. The wolf slides up the banister like Mary Poppins.
Huh.
And then there's Droopy reading a Dick Tracy comic book.
Guess who?
Droopy turns to us and says, "I surprising like this all through the picture." That's another Avery staple, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to... It definitely seems like one of those things from old cartoons, but I was wondering if it was specific to Avery.
I don't know, because I know he does it later in Screwball Squirrel.
Okay.
He does the same kind of thing of, you know, I
do stuff like this to him all through the
all
picture.
All through the picture, yeah. It feels very, very Avery to me, and I think we'll see it again. I love it. I find it amusing every time. Oh, and it's in...
Yeah, it's fun.
Oh, I want to say it's in Wabbit Twubble.
Oh,
I really think Bugs Bunny does it to Elmer, says that about or to Elmer Fudd in a cartoon, and I think it was a cartoon not directed by Tex.
I do this kind of stuff to him all through the picture.
I think it's something that could only be done in the 40s or 50s. Like, you need the silent era and the 1930s to establish basically how cartoon works, and then once we already get the gist, then it's nice to have the cartoon star tell us. We all know how this works now, right? The wolf travels by map from city to city across the U.S., always reacting at, we imagine, the sight of Droopy already there. When he gets to Hollywood, his reaction is a, woo-woo! How do you interpret this gag?
Yeah, I was going to ask you the same thing. I mean, normally when a straight male coded cartoon character reacts like that to anything, it's because he has encountered an attractive female character.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, I don't know. He saw a good-looking movie star or something.
He went somewhere in West Hollywood, like to a club or something, or maybe, or do we know where Red Hot Riding Hood takes place? Could that have been?
Oh, I don't know. Like, is there a name of the club in that?
Oh, I'd have to find it, and I don't have it handy right now.
Because I wouldn't be surprised if it takes place at a club with a name that was a spoof of a real club in Hollywood.
Right. It very well could be a Hollywood club.
Yeah.
In which case, maybe the entirety of Red Hot Riding Hood takes place in this one moment.
Yeah.
Once again, I'm bringing the big-brained headcanons here.
Yeah.
Hope you folks enjoy that. He runs up to the North Pole and hides in an igloo. Before he turns around, he looks at us and says, "Yeah, I know. He'll be right there behind me." Instead, he turns around and sees a sign that says, "Nope, it's too cold." Then the telephone rings, the wolf answers, and Droopy says, "Mr. Killer, don't look now, but you've got company." So after making a few very funny faces of distress,
yes.
He covers his eyes, stoops down, turns around, uncovers his eyes. Droopy says, "Peekaboo." We get a reaction. I think this raises the question, what was the point of the sign that said Droopy wasn't there?
Yeah, this is this is a flaw in the logic of this very otherwise logical cartoon.
Yeah.
I feel we gotcha, Tex. Just pick one or the other. Either have the sign or have Droopy there. But yeah,
right.
it doesn't really.
It's just like
it's that, distracting to have both.
That sign is such a good gag. And so I understand why they felt the need to use it. But then once you do that, the cartoon has nowhere to go if he's successfully escaped.
That's the end. Yeah. He's like, "Well, I lost him."
And so I think once again, we get to the principle of Tex Avery cartoons, gags for gag's sake.
Yeah, you're right.
And, you know, it's fine. I think it'll be clear to our listeners that neither of us are actually trying to own this cartoon for a serious mistake.
And if that's the only thing that we really sort of take exception to in this whole thing, then that's not bad.
I like that when the wolf freaks out here and his pants fall down, he's wearing boxer shorts that have the same striped design as the rest
yeah,
of his outfit.
They do a lot with the stripes of his old-fashioned prison uniform. Like sometimes the stripes will move or kind of roll up on themselves when he does a take. They really take advantage of the design of that uniform.
Yeah. The wolf runs back down to New York. As he makes a sharp turn, he slides right out of the film strip and runs back into it. By my count, that's the sixth car brake and screeching tires sound effect in the cartoon.
Huh.
That was the point at which I started to count. Like, how many times have we heard the car come to a halt as the sound effect for the running or whatever? It's a lot. The wolf jumps into a manhole, and we get the classic trope of the eyes being the only thing we can see in the dark.
Yeah.
I recently found an earlier example of it than this, so I know it's been around for a while, but I don't remember what it was.
I would guess that maybe it goes back even to pre-animation, maybe from comic strips or like, yeah, I don't know.
Oh,
that would be my guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So the wolf runs up a building and Droopy asks,
"What kept you?"
"Oh, not again. Now listen, Hotshot. I'm plenty fed up with his chasing stuff, see? You come one step closer and I'll jump. And I will, too."
He kind of flutters his eyelashes when he says that. He's
yeah.
playing coy.
Oh, well, actually, you know, everyone says that he's fluttering his eyelashes, but believe it or not, this puppet's eyes never move. It's just Frank Oz's performance
Whoa.
That give you that sense
so
of the eyes batting. Yeah, that joke is only for the Muppet fans listening. I haven't figured out where this line comes from, that, and I will too. But it always appears in like a Bob Clampett Warner Brothers cartoon or something. It's in Tortoise Wins by a Hair, which is Clampett's follow up to Avery's Tortoise Beats Hare. So it's around. It's around.
I bet it's yet another one of those things that comes from a radio, like a comedy radio show that we just don't know what it was anymore.
Yeah, or a vaudeville show or something.
Avery directed one of the Tortoise and the Hare cartoons?
I think that's right? I'm pretty sure.
Those are similar in tone to this, with the unusual angle of being the rare cartoon where Bugs Bunny loses.
Yep. Got a lot of mixed feelings about loser Bugs.
Yeah, well, he's frustrated in a similar way to how the wolf is in this.
Right. Yeah, those are so... That's such a strange series of cartoons. And it's interesting that, like, the first one of those is very early on in the life of Bugs Bunny. It's one of his first few cartoons. And yeah. I think it's the second time that Avery ever directs Bugs, right? Like, Bugs, like Avery does the first canonical Bugs Bunny cartoon with a wild hare.
Right.
And then his next time with Bugs is this Tortoise and the Hare cartoon that completely changes Bugs's role in the story. And at least according to Chuck Jones interviews, big asterisk there to take that with a grain of salt, Tex Avery then found himself wondering what the heck happened to this character that we just created. what happened? Because because the whole idea of the comic winner that was so definitive of Bugs was kind of broken there. But there's definitely a close connection between these droopy chase cartoons and those Tortoise and the Hare cartoons. I don't find Cecil nearly as appealing as Droopy. Like, Cecil just angers me, whereas I'm rooting for Droopy.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree, although I don't mind Bugs losing in those because those cartoons are so funny. Like, that, to me, that...
Fair enough.
that overpowers the whatever might be unsatisfying about them. But I would agree about Cecil the turtle.
I mean, there are a lot of examples of loser Bugs. So I shouldn't be, like, you know, I'm fine with it in Baton Bunny, The Falling Hare. Actually, it bothered me a little bit in The Falling Hare as a kid. I'm fine with it now because it's funny.
I had on a tape of public domain cartoons, and that one...
So did I,
That one is special to me, so that one I love.
Right, it's kind of hard to knock that one. It's a really terrific, beautiful Clampett cartoon. Which of these... I think it's Northwest Hounded Police has... It is. That Droopy cartoon has the same ending with the million Droopies.
Right. Turns out, like, there's a whole family of turtles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, there's, like, 100 Droopies. So, same
ideas moving around from studio to studio all the time. That's why I like doing this podcast in a way that bounces around from studio to studio a little bit, because they're kind of connected. Droopy, I think, gets much more malevolent at this point, where he decides to, like, step forward to make the wolf jump from the building. I'm not sure how I feel about that. We get a great shot from the top of the building showing where it is on a map of the mid-Atlantic region of the United States.
Yes, it's an extremely tall building.
Take it as far as it can go. And I love the Undertaker gag. I love that he tips his hat, the Undertaker tips his hat when he's finished, and then he just holds his arms in, and somehow that enables him to just fly back up to his room.
Yes, the Undertaker essentially is in free fall along with the wolf, and then just sort of leaps back up.
It's beautiful. The wolf stops himself with the seventh car brake sound in the picture. Droopy's giant rock is also funny to me, not just because of its size or because of how tiny Droopy is compared to it, although that's all funny, but because it looks so much more realistic than anything else in the whole cartoon.
Yeah, I noticed that.
This beautifully painted, detailed rock. When I watched this cartoon for the first time in a few years for this podcast, this bit where he drops the rock struck me as pretty extreme on Droopy's part. Like, it was kind of a shocking thing. Like, oh my gosh, he's going to drop that on the wolf who he already pushed off a building. So then the part where he says, yes, you're right, it is gruesome, really worked for me. Because in that case, the cartoon was reading my mind. Like, it's right. So rare for these notes that comment on what we've seen to actually express exactly what I was thinking. But there, I was thinking, oh my gosh, that's gruesome. And then Drewby said, yes, you're right, it is gruesome.
Right, especially because we acknowledged earlier how passive Drewby actually is in this cartoon. But in that moment, yeah, you're like, whoa, dang, Drewby, that is gruesome. You're right.
He becomes the killer.
And I think it's safe to assume that line is what inspires the line he has in his cameo in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, when he's the elevator operator in Toontown and he causes Eddie Valiant to get smushed at the bottom of the elevator, right, and turns to the camera and says, gruesome, isn't it, folks?
Oh, I forgot that was his line in that moment. But yeah, that probably comes from this.
Yeah, I assume so.
That's where I first saw Drewby, I bet.
I bet that's where a lot of people first saw Drewby, actually. Yeah, but you might not even really register it because it's a very brief cameo is what it is.
Right, but you know what's really great about that? The fact that they then gave him a very brief cameo in the other Roger Rabbit shorts.
Yeah, he comes back in all, is it three of them after that?
I think that it's two or three, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's great.
It's got to be three, right? There's the amusement park, the woods.
Tummy Trouble, and Roller Coaster Rabbit, and Trail Mix Up. Those are
very nice. Very
thanks.
Nice.
That was off the top of my head, just for the record.
Wow.
Awesome. I was not Googling that.
Drewby also then gets cameos in like the direct-to-video Tom and Jerry movies. If you've ever seen any of those.
I read that when I was reading his Wikipedia page for this. I have not seen any of those. And I looked to see if any of those are very easily accessible online. I couldn't find any. So have you seen any of those?
I've seen clips at the very least. And yeah. I just like that they keep the tradition going. My wish is that Disney, Warner Brothers would all do whatever they have to do to give Drewby cameos in everything. Like, since he's already cameoed in Disney stuff much more than any other Warner Brothers owned character.
Yeah,
I think the law for Drewby, since he's already such a logic breaking character, should be that he gets to cameo in any animated project from any studio and you don't get to question it. Then we get some creative economic storytelling. As the boulder lands on the wolf, what we see crashing down is not the boulder itself, but the front page of the newspaper that says, killer captured. Drewby is pictured on the newspaper under the headline, the dog dude it.
Yes, I dude it is a Red Skelton catchphrase, the comedian Red Skelton.
It is a very popular radio comedian and later television comedian. He had a character called the Mean Whittle Kid, or sometimes called Junior, who talked in a kid voice and said, I dude it a lot. That's the whole joke. And Tex relied on dude it jokes. A lot of these cartoons did, but Tex in particular just kept relying on dude it jokes for a long time. Drewby is rewarded for his efforts with a big stack of money and suddenly gets a huge smile on his face and springs to life, yelping and hollering and doing flips and blowing a party horn and firing guns before snapping back to a restrained pose and his droopy face to tell us, I'm happy. And that's the end.
He's happy. And we're happy because that was a very good cartoon.
The guns get me. It's part of this beautiful transformation on Droopy's part into a traditional Tex Avery character out of nowhere. And interestingly, the aforementioned animator, John Canemaker, pointed out, he pointed out that Drewby and Tex were actually a lot like in this regard, in that Tex was so unassuming and mild-mannered in his real life. Hmm. And then you'd see in his cartoons how he expressed everything that was inside of him and find just this wild, outrageous energy.
That does seem to kind of happen a lot. Like, you hear that with stand-up comedians who are just very mild-mannered and normal as people, and then they get on stage and they're crazy.
You know, I couldn't find anything for the words on the rock. This rock knocks him colder than a wet mackerel. But I also wonder if that was a Tex thing, because colder in a wet mackerel, that has kind of a southern accent to it. And
yeah,
Tex Avery famously inserted his Texas sayings into his cartoons, like, what's up, Doc, was the sort was what everyone at his high school in Texas was saying. And so I wonder if maybe they were also all going around saying this rock knocks him colder than a wet mackerel at his high school in Texas.
Or probably just, not, just, but maybe other uses of the phrase a wet mackerel, because that's just a funny collection very of funny. Words.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And since you mentioned that, I'll just
are you going to plug Texas?
Yeah, well, just Tex Avery was born in the same county in which I currently reside.
Very congratulations, right? Is there a statue?
You know, I should look that up. I should see. There's got to be like a plaque or something on a...
If not, then you have to put one up. You have to put up a plaque or a statue or something.
I'll put a little sign with a picture of Droopy.
Do like a Tex Avery style sign. Like it has to... be just like a whiteboard on a wooden stick somewhere that okay. is like Tex Avery was, and then everything else is in really tiny print so that you can get a really, really long message in there. Yeah. And then at the very end, it can say in big letters, long, wasn't it?
I'll work on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes. Tex would not go on to be an Academy darling, but proved to be a darling to most everybody else. And his co-workers turned competitors at Warner Brothers. And to the other directors at MGM, he was quite the inspiration. He later directed a few cartoon shorts for Walter Lantz that are pretty well liked. And Droopy, of course, would go on to have a legacy as the dog who cameos in absolutely everything, I hope. Mm-hmm. Ryan, do you have any final thoughts on this cartoon?
You know what? One thing in my notes, I tried to read some of the newspaper text when that final newspaper came down. Mm-hmm. Most of it I couldn't really make out, but there's a column called Laughs of the Week. And it says, what's the difference between a worm and a bedbug? Well, a worm crawls on its own stomach, while a bedbug is not as particular. So that's a... there's your laugh of the week.
Okay. All right.
You're welcome.
Well, hold on. Give me a second. I'm thinking about it. So by not as particular, it means the worm crawls on his own stomach, but the bed bug could... is that what it was? A bed bug?
I think the bed bug might as well crawl
on your stomach.
Exactly. Yeah. A bed bug will crawl
and
on your
stomach.
And
now that I think about it that way...
There you go.
This is the most I've laughed all week.
Yeah, just imagine, you know, that's what people were reading in the newspaper to get their laughs in those days.
Wow. Folks, it's about time for us to say so long. But before we do, we'll tell you where you can find us. Ryan, where should people go to find you or your work or anything you'd like to plug?
Besides
Texas,
frequently...
we know that you should go to Texas to find you.
I mean, if you really want to. But if you want to look for stuff that I wrote, I frequently write for toughpegs.com, the Muppet fan website. I am a co-host of the Moving Right Along Muppet Movie podcast. As previously mentioned, we are on a hiatus as we record this, but soon-ish we will start talking about Muppets from Space. And if you want to follow me on Letterboxd, and I love when people follow me on Letterboxd, I am there at Movies Are Neat.
Wonderful. Yes. And folks, you can probably find me somewhere on social media, Blue Sky at JD11PC. You can read my writing about Muppets at toughpigs.com as well, where you will also find my podcast, The Great Muppet Fandom Panel. Please be sure to give us a review so more people can find us. And remember, the next time you think you can escape Droopy, stick to shorts.